1. Well, hello.
Hello. And welcome.
To another.
To another.
Episode. Now batting.
Batting.
Manny Mota.
Also known as Considering Some Things, everybody.
Welcome back to Considering Some Things. I am Mark Storer. That is
Keith Cox. Howdy.
And we are, it's a Tuesday night. There's no, tomorrow's Veterans Day. We honor our veterans by sleeping in. It's the best honor that we can pay.
Well, I'll be doing some color guard stuff with the American Legion, actually, just so you know.
Are you really?
Yeah, for reals.
What do you do?
We are going to do colors with the flag and, you know, do the anthem and all that good stuff. And stuff.
I
like
bet
that.
You don't even know the anthem.
I don't put me under pressure like that. You know, that's one of the few things that I am horrified. You know how many offers I've gotten to sing the anthem, and I'm horrified to do it. I'm literally afraid to sing the anthem because if I screw it up, I will never.
Yeah, you'll
be
never
happy.
Be back.
I can't. No. I'm afraid to do it.
I'd have to fire you if you screwed it up.
It would be one of those things. I know that I would screw it up somehow. And, you know, I've practiced it because I can do it. You know, I can. I found my range. I found my key. And I'm like, I'm still afraid to do it. I think I just need to go out and do it one time and get paid. And I've been offered. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, not. So I've got a couple of friends who specialize in the anthem. And that's what they love to do in their thing. And I'm like, you go.
You anyway, go do it.
It doesn't matter if you screw up, you know, a Tom Petty song. But, man. You screw up the anthem. Good God. You know, and you know, you watch the YouTube bloopers on that and you're like, I just would not want to be that person. So I now avoid
that funky noise you hear in the background is the Considering Some Things love child.
Yes.
That was born.
I know a lot of people think that might belong to somebody else, but like someone named Peter and Anna, but it's not. That's ours.
Keith's and mine.
That's our kid, yeah.
Considering Some Things, love child.
Love child.
So, well, why don't you introduce these fine people who we have on our show this evening?
Okay, but first, I want everybody to know that this episode is brought to you by 805 Musician Network. 805 Musician Network is a Facebook group site for musicians only, and especially musicians within the 805. The goal of the 805 Musician Network is to help musicians help each other. That is the goal. So if you're looking for a project, the 805 Musician has it. If you're looking for venues to help to find, the 805 Musician Network has it. It's a great place, especially in these trying times where none of us are getting gigs. It's a great place to come and bitch about how you're not getting any gigs. So if you're a musician and you're on the 805, anywhere in the 805 from Ventura all the way up to Paso, it's a great place to be, the 805 Musician Network.
Do you think that soon Governor Newsom will take down the 805 Musician Network?
Well, he joined, but you know, I don't know why we let him on. It was really weird.
Well, he has a winery.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's because he's spying on musicians. Where'd you get the gig? I don't want to even talk about all the turncoats. I'm going to get irritated, and that's a whole other subject. But
well, then I will tell you that we're also brought to you by Nabu Wines. Nabu Wines in Westlake Village, California, NABUWines.com. 15% discount, Nabu15. And they have fast, free local delivery in the LA County, Ventura County area. So if you're not in those areas, they ship to 11 different states. They make varietals from Napa and from Malibu Coast AVAs. They are beautiful, beautiful varietals along with some wonderful blends. And you would not miss out. Plus, great local outdoor tasting in Westlake Village with a great music setup. There is music going on at Nabu Wines. You know, Keith hasn't been invited, but there are reasons for that. So,
well, now I'm going to call and turn them in. I'm turning them in.
But NabuWines.com, Greg Barnett and Jeff Bailey making some great wines in Westlake Village.
Good for you, Nabu, and thanks for supporting local live music. Speaking of some wonderful people, I'd like to talk about our guests a little bit. So we are really fortunate to have Peter and Anna. They are the founders, proprietors, and winemakers of Final Girl Wines. I fell in love with this wine, sipping it when I was at a place called Vino ed Amici, and they are our local wine bar here, and just
in Santa Maria.
In Santa Maria, I should say, or specifically Orchid, if we want to be specific. Orchid.
I think you should be specific.
Yes, go to Orchid, and there's a place called Vino ed Amici, and they have Final Girl Wines. I fell in love with it, and not just because I'm a huge horror movie fan, and when I saw Final Girl with that, I saw that chainsaw, and like, oh my God, I knew the reference immediately, and I was like, yeah! I was like a little kid. I get so excited about horror stuff. I admit it, I'm a weird junkie, but when he was pouring it, and I had the Petit Verdot, oh my God, it was just brilliant. It's one of my favorite wines. I really enjoy their stuff. So introducing Peter and Anna. Hi, say hi, you two.
Hello.
Hi, you two.
All right. Well, thank you. Perfect. Thank you for
Sorry, segueing from dad jokes. We also have our third wheel along with us, the love child that you guys were talking about beforehand.
It's okay. The contribution to love child.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess the jig is up. That is not our kid in the background. That is Peter and Anna's little final kid.
Yeah. Exactly.
What's your baby's name? I know you told me and I forgot.
Julian.
Julian.
Okay.
Yeah.
Julian. That's a very Australian name. Or is it not?
Yeah, I mean, I know some who are Australian. I don't know. We got it from, maybe I was listening to a lot about the Byzantine Empire at the time or something. There's a good name.
Very cool. Yep.
As you do.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, that's fine.
As one does.
I mean, we probably should have figured out what the name of that specific god was in Ghostbusters, you know, that bit at the end where they say, because he does seem to behave a little bit like the destroyer, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, his little chubby guy running around destroying everything, wrecking our albums and
That's a good boy. I love Julian. That actually does have this like horror context. That's a great, powerful name. I love that name. Julian's a great name. Love and it. He will probably rule the earth one day.
Oh, so, God, I hope not.
Well, it's great to have you guys. Thanks for being here. Your winery is unique, as Keith alluded to. You have chosen a horror theme which appeals to Keith Cox and like five or six. No, I'm joking. But what is it about horror that is so attractive to a couple of winemakers?
Yeah, well, actually, it sort of goes back to the story of how Peter and I met. I was on vacation in New Zealand, and he was at the time living in New Zealand, although he's Australian and not from New Zealand. and we met at a friend of a friend's birthday party. At any rate, we were talking, and the two things we kept talking about were wine. He was very impressed that I was a winemaker, and he mm-hmm. loves wine. And we were talking about the zombie apocalypse, mm-hmm. what attributes we would each bring, you know, to the zombie apocalypse team. And that was pretty fitting because Peter is actually a horror movie screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
So horror and wine are two things that both of us have loved for a very long time.
Yeah.
Do you drink wine while watching? Oh, there's that feedback. Oh. Hey, do you drink wine while watching horror films?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's necessary sometimes in the really scary ones. It kind of takes the edge off.
Occasionally, I drink wine while doing the washing. You know, like, so there's all sorts of occasions for wine.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Anna, so you've been making wine. Going back, because I love how you tie in the horror thing, but going back to your winemaking days, how long have you been making wine? I assume that's just something you've been doing for quite a while, yes?
Yeah, for 18 years now. So,
okay.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I actually decided to be a winemaker because of the movie industry, I guess. I'm from LA, and I kind of feel like if you're from LA, you got to do something movie related. So I basically saw a movie and decided that's what I wanted to do for my career, which was I saw the movie French Kiss. When I was 13. So luckily, my parents were very supportive, and they were like, sure, that's a thing you can learn to do. And I ended up going to UC Davis and studying winemaking and grape growing there. And then
Davis has a great program. Yeah.
Yeah. An excellent program. And you know, Cal Poly has a great program too, as well as Fresno. At the time, Cal Poly didn't have the same program, so Davis it was. And after studying there for 4 years, I moved to Napa and lived and worked in Napa and Sonoma at a few different wineries for 10 years before moving down back here to the Central Coast.
So you've been doing it for and you went on vacation. What drew you to New Zealand? Was it just purely vacation, or was there some wine thing that you were doing, or was it just
Over the years, I'd actually, prior to that trip, I'd gone and worked in New Zealand and made wine in New Zealand at a few different wineries a few different times. And so on that particular trip, I was going back to visit some friends and run a half marathon at one of their wineries.
So now the New Zealand wines, how do you differentiate? What do they really specialize in? I mean,
they're really known for their Sauvignon Blanc is like the thing that they're most known for. But they actually make really fantastic Rieslings, in my opinion, and really nice Pinot Noirs as well.
Yeah, their Pinot Noirs are some of my favorites. And the soil apparently is really, really friendly there to the Pinot Noir grape.
Yeah. Where you worked in, one of them wasn't in, was it Hawke's Bay or something?
Yeah, I also worked in Hawke's Bay, and in Hawke's Bay it's a warmer climate, and they actually have, there's like a lot of old riverbeds with like river stones that radiate the heat back, so they actually grow Bordeaux varietals there.
Yeah.
Which nice.
That's one of the few places in New Zealand where they have Bordeaux varietals.
But then you've got also like in Central Otago, which I think is probably like top, easily playing, you know, semi-finals for best place in the world for a Pinot Noir. So, like as in, you know, you've got probably, where would be the couple of places here? There's,
I'd say Santa Barbara County, of course. Oregon is, you know, world-class Pinot Noirs.
Don't mind that. That's just the kid, right?
And the Russian River Valley up in Sonoma County.
Yes. And then you've got, obviously, in France. And then Central Otago is probably, one of the best in the world. Really great Pinot Noirs there. And actually, funnily enough, one of the better wine makers over in Central Otago is actually Sam Neill's winery.
That's right. I've read about it. Absolutely.
Yeah, like really excellent quality Pinot Noir. They rate very, very highly in most reviews and things. I think he's been doing it since the early 90s off the top of my head, I think. But he's actually...
Sam Neill was in a great horror movie called In the Mouth of Madness. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Are you serious?
Mouth of Madness, a great way to... a great way to watch a film at the end, right?
Absolutely.
It's 30 years ago, so it's fine.
A great movie. That was actually probably one of the first real horror movies that I watched. I remember being in junior high school and I was in drama class, and that inspired me to do my so I had to write my own monologue and perform it, and I basically did a very similar concept to In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah, which is
wow.
It was about aliens.
Yeah, another early.
I also watched a lot of X-Files at the time.
I love X-Files was one of my favorite shows.
Real healthy television movie viewing choices for a 12-year-old. It's totally fine.
That was good.
Horror fanatics, it always starts at a young age. I go back to I think the first horror movie I saw, my dad took us to a drive-in movie or whatever. He was just a weekend thing. Took the kids. We saw this 70s movie called Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
Oh, yeah.
Campy 70s thing where they, these dumb hippie kid, whatever, they go on this little island. There's a graveyard and they dig up a body. And of course, they say these stupid incantations and zombies. Yay. Scared the crap out of me as a kid, horrified.
70s had all, if the exception of something like The Exorcist, the 70s had all these weird names and stuff. So I think Get Scared Jessica to Death, which is another great one. It's like they're just like verbs, films that are phrases rather than titles. So, but that's great, that one.
It was odd. A lot of people don't know because it's just this obscure 70s flick. And of course, I think I saw The Exorcist when I was 12. And there's my parents who's just like, hey, I want to go see The Exorcist in the walk. And they're like, okay, sure. And they let me go. That movie gave me nightmares for weeks. That's still to this day, out of all the scary movies I've seen, that was the topper for me. And, haunted me for a long time. And it's still that's my, litmus test for scary mm-hmm. movies. I've seen a lot of great ones since, but that one still frightens me, you know, and well, I love, you know.
You wouldn't be talking to Anna if it wasn't for that film, actually, because that was the first date of her parents.
So my parents, they were friends in college, but then like they finally went on a date. My dad took my mom to see that movie and then conveniently got lost on the way home, like taking her home, and drove through the LA cemetery.
Oh my god! That's
the kind of guy that he is.
Yeah.
Which explains why I love horror so much.
He's actually quite a horror. Yeah. That's exactly he would still pull off a prank like that, more or less today.
Yeah.
If he could. Yeah.
I want to hang out with your dad. He seems cool.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, the three of you, because I've known Keith for so long, and I knew he was into horror, but you guys have a pretty broad and wide, well, I guess broad and deep knowledge of horror films going way back into the 70s. And so I'm fascinated. This genre is really the thing. I know lots of people who are into it, and Keith's always been the one that lead me into it. I am the opposite. I really can't. It's nothing. There's no principle behind it. There's no depth of thought behind it. They scare me. I don't like to be scared.
So we can jump the gauntlet now and challenge you on those premises.
Exactly. I can debate you. There is premise. Well, there is
actually. I would say this across the board.
Yeah, I just want to clear. I don't mean that they don't have a principle. It's me. I don't have a principle behind not liking them.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't. Right. I'm not sitting here on some high horse going, "Oh, horror films are terrible." I think they're fine. They scare me. I can't do them.
Well, on the bright side, if it wasn't for the Terminator, you wouldn't be dating. You wouldn't be married right now, too.
That's very true. Is that considered a horror film?
No, you thought it was. You wouldn't go.
I would technically go. Like, this is that horror sci-fi genre that sort of.
It was horror sci-fi. Yeah.
I totally think that if the concept itself is scary, then it is like Aliens to me is Jaws in space, right? And it hits it beat by beat, and I think that's pretty scary for me. Terminators probably should be for everyone the most scariest damn film of all time, because it's the most realistic horror film that can actually manifest itself in the next 30 years. i.e. nuclear holocaust or AI taking over control of our species. So, you know, that is like, it's up there with some of the highest risks that mankind faces right now. So
that's a great point, Peter. That's a great point because we don't discuss about the AI thing, and where we are just embracing technology left and right. But that is, I think you're absolutely right, a very real potential issue. I mean, some Elon Musk has warned against it, and many others are saying, you know, we get developing AI and robots. That's what I love, the whole robot thing, you know, and you know, like the West Worlds and, you know, all the new where AI, where all of a sudden they become sentient and things. I mean, when does that happen? And when are they there? You're your own person now. And, you know, Westworld. I don't know if you've seen the new Westworld that was out on HBO. It was brilliant.
Yeah, unfortunately, we haven't done that because we never got around to subscribing to HBO. We've seen, you know, the one thing that we were able to see very quickly was the other thing that scared the pants out of me last year, which was Chernobyl, which was also another.
Oh, my God. Horrifying.
Yeah. Was it really?
Oh, if you've seen it, because it's real. I mean, it's all real. And you're seeing it, like, dealing with that. And the horror of like, it was sit on your edge, your stomach's queasy the whole time watching that.
And even using some of the horror tropes as well, or the methodology. So for example, there's this one scene, it's probably not giving too much away, but there's a group of people who are going underground to try to take on, but they have to do a particular task and it's quite radiated. They've only got a certain amount there. And then the lights suddenly go out. This is the very last scene of one of the episodes. The lights suddenly go out, and all you hear is this increasing Geiger counters going off the charts. And it was like, oh my God, that's so scary.
It was horrifying. And you know, those dudes were doomed. I mean,
apparently, I think all of them survived, including like they were going, there's some interesting things about those three. I mean, I think they all eventually died from some kind of cancer or what have you, but they didn't like suddenly die. There were a lot of the people on top of the roof who were like, you know, taking bits of rock and throwing them over that they had to get rid of that were radiated. A lot of them got sick and died really quickly. But those guys, for some reason, weren't. Yeah, and definitely recommend anyone to watch it.
No, and I'm with you. Some of the best horror is real life stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's like actually Chernobyl. So that's actually a little bit like my writing partner and I. That's kind of a little bit like our branding when we ever do like the sorts of horror that we like to do is always based in some kind of real world interpretation. So if there's a supernatural element, there's a scientific reasoning behind it. Either someone's manipulating you or something along those lines. But yeah,
right. It's always been now we talk about zombie apocalypse. That could be, you know, the supernatural zombie, or it could be the man-made virus zombie. Mm-hmm. So, which I've always subscribed to, if there's really going to be one, it's going to be some man-made virus that wipes out, you know, world really fast. You know,
that's where we are right now.
Well, you know,
It's a practice run.
They got to take that virus, put some bath salts in there, and then boom.
Chuck a little bit of rabies in there and off we go. We've basically got our, if we get a bit of rabies and make it last a little bit longer, we've got our zombie, right?
Yep. And then maybe 1% decaf coffee just to piss you off.
Just to make people really angry.
The rage. What? Decaf? Brains.
Susan, I'm going to split your head open and eat your brains. Just if you give me decaf one more time.
So now
is there, let me ask this, because Keith, you could help answer it too.
Maybe.
This is really fascinating to me, because I think what I'm witnessing or at least hearing is a lot of the horror genre is not just fantasizing, but literally thinking about, you know, worst case scenarios, right? About, hey, this could go wrong. And if it does, there's some bad stuff coming down the road. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Yeah,
I would
say so.
Yeah, I think broadly you could sort of think of it as a little bit like genre in general. Sci-fi does this, but horror does as well. That broadly in general, it's exploring like metaphor, and that can be like either, you know, what is the worst case scenario of something, but it can interpret. It can either do that, or it can be a metaphor for something else. So, for example, there was a film that came out 2 years ago, which was a zombie film. Just sticking to the theme. That was based out of, it was based in Ireland. I think it had, what's her face from Juno?
Ellen Page.
I think Ellen Page. And basically what it was is that it was the aftermath of the zombie apocalypse where they got the cure and all the people who were zombies got healed. But there was all these restrictions on them. A lot of them had actually, while in state, killed family members or other people. So they were like treated like second-class citizens. So the metaphor there was really about, refugees in Europe. That was kind of the things that it was talking about. And so what it was doing was using the context of a zombie apocalypse to explore the themes and the philosophies that were happening in the world at the time. And sci-fi and horror have done this in the 50s and 60s with the Red Scare. They've done that with, you know, a range of different sorts of issues. You always find that genre plays with the ideas that sometimes real world doesn't want to deal with. Like, no one wants to do a film like about mass shooting or terrorist attacks, say, for example. So they might explore it in another form, and they can talk about the same ideas.
And there's so many.
Wow, that's a lot of echo.
That is a lot of echo. That can't be me, right? Is that?
Yeah, that's you. Well, no, it's not you. It's I think it's on Peter Nana's end. It's just the speaker. Yeah,
We can try headphones in if that helps.
Yeah, please do. Okay. Please do.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's try. Sorry about this.
No, don't. Keep going, Keith.
Yeah, yeah. So, and going back to that type of genre, zombies or any type of dystopian future, and there's so many different variations of that. And like, it's supposed to make you uncomfortable. Like, okay, the world ends. How do you deal with it? If it's a zombie thing, okay, how do you deal with it? If it's we all starved, we ran out of water. There's so many horrific, virus wiped everybody out. So many different genres just in that topic. Or aliens attacked, and you know, it's this weird future that we're all doomed, and you know, and how do we survive that? I love that kind of genre only because it's like, well, how would I deal with that? I always like to hear that. Would I be a survivor? I always believe that I will be. I'll be the type of the guy that, you know, survives. But the reality is, you know, when the world gets really hard, how tough really are we? Because we're spoiled right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a great movie that's similar on that theme would be like at the moment, a great movie, but I enjoyed it, was Antebellum.
I've heard about the issue of
slavery. But what I did like about it is because it sort of like starts out in this modern world, it actually shows you like what it must be like if you now, and it doesn't even have to be necessarily the context of American slavery, but in general, if you were taken from your life right now, and you were put into a position of slavery, you know, what that would be like. And it sort of explains that, you know, what it must have been like for an ordinary person in any time of history just to be taken away and be forced into servitude.
Sort of like, you know, if there were like a pandemic that stopped you from doing the career that you love and you couldn't do it anymore. And so the government just had to pay you a subsistence wage while you went away.
Well, so they would know what they're doing now, which is not paying you a subsistence wage, paying you basically.
Yeah, really. They're not even doing that.
But I would suggest that there are a few more elements to slavery apart from that one. certainly. It's probably more akin to serfdom rather than slavery.
Yeah, I agree.
But, you know, the
road to serfdom.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the pandemic thing has obviously hit, you know, a lot of people pretty hard, and it certainly had an effect on us and changed our business model. And, you know, we've had to do a lot less work with our partners in the wine shops and the wine cellars and things. But they've been on again, off again, open and closed. And for a lot of like, you know, our two places that we sort of consider our wine tasting rooms where we have all of our wines and where we would even go down and talk through our wines, which is Vino et Amici's, which I think Keith, you talked about earlier, and the Good Life in Solvang, like the rules have been particularly confusing, you know, for them, although they haven't really said anything to me. But it's like the open, you know, the different conditions to being open, the greater restrictions because they consider them a bar when they're not a bar at all. They're supporters of like local boutique winemakers. So, you know, if anything, I do want to encourage people, especially if you're in the area, go down to Vino et Amici and the Good Life. For nothing else, you'll actually get some really, really good quality wine that you probably wouldn't see on stores, you know. So, or at the shopping centers or large sellers. So if you want to see
cool, smaller producers, you can't really find.
Yeah, if you want to get the rock and roller, you know, wine labels up and coming, you know, that's the place you want to go to. So.
It's funny you say that. I was just saying to Keith, was it today, Keith, or the other night, that if I were to get into the wine business as a way to make a living now, which is something I'm actually looking at doing, that's what the direction I'd like to go is to be able to represent these beautiful boutique wines like you guys are making, you know, unique stuff and really kind of experimenting. That's enjoyable as heck. I have to admit, there's a part of it. It's just like, hey, this is fun to taste. I want to taste all this great stuff, you know, and see what's happening.
So, Peter Anna, how many distributors or dealers, I guess, do you have in California?
How many dealers do we have all across California?
Locally, yeah,
I know.
Good it life.
Feels like I'm in Boys in the Hood now.
Dealers. Dealers.
Yeah. So, yeah. Like, it's just... anyway, this is a guy I know who works for the CIA who import. Nah.
I was thinking like a Husqvarna dealer, okay? Yeah, Husqvarna. They don't. They won't go to.
Yeah, because they have a lot of.
I just
wine.
Had to go all Iran Contra, didn't I? Just have to, you know, ambitious targets.
I just felt bad for saying dealer.
You should. Why don't you go to your room?
I am. Let me know when you guys start talking horror again. I'm just going to walk away.
Okay, yeah. All right. There's a few places. So Vino et Amici's and the Good Life in Solvang. So Vino et Amici's in Orchid and the Good Life in Solvang are our two main places around this area, which is like our wine tasting room because you can do a flight there, you can try all of our wines. So those are the two main focal points. But then we're in a few other places in and around Santa Barbara County as well. So there's a place called Uncorked, in Santa Barbara, Ellie's Tap and Vine. They've all got sort of like one or two of different kinds of our wines. So, like, you know, different places will have a different focus, mainly because, you know, they may already have another, you know, rosé, so they don't need to take on another one. They probably have a lot more rosés. They need to take on another one. So that's in sort of this area as well. I'm trying to think. Clean Slate and the Wine Merchant Cafe. But Community and Craft, which is another place that they have our...
really small, like craft wine and beer.
Yeah, craft wine and beer again.
Los Olivos?
Los Olivos, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and then going down south, so we're in V Wine Room, which is in West Hollywood. We're in Vino Vore. In East Hollywood, all the places starting with V, really. We Olive and Wine Bar in Pasadena, which had a really good special on, actually, just leading up to Halloween. Would have been, I would have said, go there. It's a great price. They were having like a buy one, get one free and two for one. Buy one, get one half off. They had half price glasses of wine, so long as you dressed up in a costume. So that was pretty fun. And then the Wine Country down in Long Beach and the Wine Lab in around Costa Mesa, I think it is.
Yeah, Costa Mesa.
I think that's a lot
you
of
know, where you do really well and sell probably a ton of wine is if. Have you ever been to Monsterpalooza?
Oh, sure. Like, so I was looking into doing that and Son of Monsterpalooza. So they've got it in April.
I used to, we would go religiously. Of course, this year, nothing. But we go not every year. And both Monster and Son of. And they're so much fun.
Funnily enough, one of the pictures that I had as well, but it's all just gone out the window now. But they had, I think, moved Monsterpalooza. I want to say to Pasadena. So I kind of wanted to sort of do a little bit of arrangement where it's like, I had to look into the details of whether you can do wine tastings and that sort of thing. But, you know, like people can try some of the wine and then buy it around the corner and say, we all live. So that would have been kind of cool. But a lot of those sort of plans are all out the window because of, I don't know, you've heard that there's some sort of a plague going around.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I'm being optimistic. I'm thinking sooner or later. Then later, you know, we're going to get out of this whole thing and maybe we can get back to normal life. So it'd be great to see you guys at Monsterpalooza because I think, of course, the wine just fits right in with that.
And yeah, well, I would say that it would be Son of if it's the one in September. So in my professional opinion, I'd say that with the virus vaccine is likely to be available in the first instance sometime around January. And the distribution will obviously go to first responders and those in higher risk categories. And then out to the general population, probably by the summer of next year. And then, you know, by September, which would be the Monsterpalooza or the Son of, it should be probably, we'd be able to start having events again, I hope.
And look on that. I'm really excited because the vaccine is either going to cure us all or create zombies. And I'm hoping.
It's going to create.
Either way, it's great for us and our branding.
It's win-win for the horror people. We're like, sweet, all zombies.
And it's good that we're actually making and then saying that that's going to happen on the podcast. If there's something that we all need right now in the world, and that is
more conspiracy theories
going around.
Yeah. I was going to say, because I have close friends and I won't divulge you because I don't think they want to talk about it, but they are, I would say that their level of fear over the vaccine is as high as most people's is over the nature of the pandemic itself. They believe that the vaccine is probably dangerous. It's not going to help anybody. It could actually kill people. And I'm sitting here going, I don't know. I mean, I get that you don't really buy into it, but boy, you're going a long way here.
The only thing that like remotely you could even start to entertain is maybe, you know, some kind of long-term effects. But let's be honest, like if it was going to start killing people willy-nilly, we would have seen it in the latest Pfizer trials. Instead of got 90% success rate. Certainly hasn't killed anyone. And I promise you this from the bottom of my heart, for someone who's worked in government, in policy and all the rest of it, it's one thing to have a conspiracy of a small number of people. It is like Think about all the problems of the world. What we're talking about here is a conspiracy that would involve the United States, China, Russia, Australia, all the middle powers, Europe, and they all agree on everything. All of them coordinated, secret meetings without any leaks that it wouldn't get out. And, and you know, like, if we had that level of coordination, then I would say that it's probably worth the conspiracy to be successful just so that we could get coordinated on something.
I feel like they would have wasted all that, though, on a vaccine.
Yeah. On a vaccine, I mean, right?
There are, trust me when I say this, and we don't have to look at too much than some of the countries that we're talking about. It is, there's a much easier way to get rid of millions of people at a time. There is a particular country that's doing that right now. Unsuccessfully, with very little implications. In fact, US companies have sort of challenged it, and you know, they've gone, "Oh, okay, well, we won't speak about that again." Sorry about that, boss.
It's not about, but see, here's the thing: it's not about getting rid of people. It's about putting nanobots in them so they'll comply.
Oh, well, I'll see again. I'll go to Occam's razor. Why would you put nanobots in there when everyone in the population is voluntarily carrying around a computer tracker that basically does
exactly? There's no need.
Yeah.
Now you're just being hurtful.
Oh, you got to educate yourself, man. Go on YouTube.
I really wanted it to be nanobots, damn it.
Keith, you are the best straight man.
I am. I will take it.
All right. You know what? So, I'll give you this. In a few years' time, they're probably going to get nanobots that go directly into your brain so you can actually access all your social media and your games and stuff directly.
There you go.
Beautiful.
Thanks. You feel better now, Keith?
I do.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for assuaging him.
Peter and I have that in common. We're both in risk management. I'm on a much lower level. I'm with the schools, but he comes from the upper, you know, government, which is where they put nanobots in people's heads. Yeah. Schools don't do that necessarily. The guy, you know, where Pete comes from, he is a nanobat guy. That's why he's never going to admit it.
Notice he said, I think he said, "Trust me," three different times.
I know he did. Trust me on this. We're here to help. Ask Anna, some nanobots.
Anna, let me cut through this and ask a wine question of you.
Sure.
Yeasts.
Have you ever put nanobats in your wine?
Stop.
Sorry.
When you're making wines these days, what kind of yeasts are you using? When you guys are making wine, what's your approach?
Well, it kind of depends. I went to school and have worked in wine industry, working for a large wine company for most of my career. Yeah. So I'm a bit of a traditionalist, but we're moving more towards a low intervention, natural wine when possible sort of approach.
Yep.
A lot of people these days are doing natural wines and that you use only native yeast and you don't make any acid adjustments or anything like that.
Which I don't know how I feel about entirely. I think it's fine. I just don't know that it's the end all be all, right? It works.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the times, you know, if you're working with a facility or something, you've already grown up sort of your endemic yeast population and you know it's going to finish your fermentations, but otherwise it's a bit of a risk. So depending on what wine, we will or won't do a native fermentation. We typically, like for our Chenin Blanc, we make a Chenin Blanc and a Petit Verdot. And for those two varietals, there's been so much scientific, you know, research over the years that you can have certain yeast strains that really amplify different characteristics that you're getting in those grapes. And so in those two particular instances, I like to select specific yeast for those grape varieties. But this year for 2020 vintage, we made an orange wine and we also made a rosé. And for those, we just let them go native and, you know, see how they go.
Our current rosé. How did
they do?
They went well. The current rosé is just really given me some stress at the end, but still fermenting, which is going very slowly.
So when we say current rosé, should clarify.
Yeah, so our 2020 rosé is a rosé of Syrah made from organic grapes.
Yeah. Our current release rosé, which is a 19, is a rosé of Merlot, and that is 100% organic.
The same vineyard. Yeah, they're both from Coplico Vineyard in Santa Ynez.
Yeah.
All right. I promised Keith I'd be nice and ask and get, because Peter, we talked about this. I think we talked about this off recording last time. Let's talk about orange wine. Let's get it out in the open, damn it.
the great debate.
Exactly. Yeah. Why? Well, obviously it's a market choice, right? You've got people that want this and so why not make it?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the way our approach in general to this brand, because let's face it, we're not doing this to get rich anytime soon. Mm-hmm. we're doing it because we enjoy it. We enjoy wines and we enjoy creating wines that we're passionate about, like varieties or regions, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of people talking about orange wines lately, and we thought we'd give it a try. A couple years ago, actually, in 2018, Peter was living in Australia due to immigration stuff. So I was over visiting him. That was the year right after we got married. So we basically had like 4 honeymoons across Australia.
Yeah, that's right.
Nice. Yeah. It was nice of you to visit him, too.
And in one of those...
She didn't know there was a 30-day policy where you can just go.
If I knew now what I knew then. We were at this winery in the Barossa Valley, and they had this orange wine, and it was really interesting. It was a bunch of random varieties that you actually don't even hear of very much, and it just tasted like just fruit punch, and it kind of also, interestingly, because typically they're unfined and unfiltered, it really like captures the sense aroma, you know, the aromas and the textures and stuff that you get of a fermenting wine, which I love. I mean, personally, as a winemaker, like my favorite time of year is harvest time, and going and tasting these fermenting juices and things, you just get so much of that like fun sensory, you know.
Do you think that orange wine is going to be similar to that sort of style, or do you think it's going to be
I think so. Exactly. Yeah, we actually tried a sample just yesterday, and it's very fruity. It's
like grapefruits and things.
Grapefruits, orange actually, like orange peel, like peach. It's just got a lot of very different like fruit characteristics to it, and the texture is interesting too. It'll also be unfined and unfiltered. So, and it goes through mouth. What's that?
Will it have pulp?
Yeah, it'll be cloudy, but not that bad.
We're gonna pack it in plastic and straws. Kids can take it.
Are you not using Florida oranges?
I just heard. I heard about that the other day. So is it basically the entire industry is dead? Is that right?
We don't know about that. I haven't heard anything
about that. Yeah, I've heard that basically because of some disease, like there's basically all Florida oranges are now gone. The entire industry's wiped out.
So. Oh my God.
Wow. I didn't hear that either. Whoa.
Yeah, someone was telling me the other day and I said, what? All of it? And they said, yeah, like all of, like, it's pretty much like all of the Florida oranges have gone corrupted from some sort of a disease.
COVID.
Oh my goodness.
But you know, it could. Nanobots. Yeah, it's probably, here you go.
Nanobots.
Do you know what it is? It's Californians trying to destroy
their business. Yeah, they probably sent over.
Yeah.
These now, orange wine, to clarify for folks, orange wine is not made of oranges.
No, it is not. No. So orange wine is essentially white grapes that are made the same way that you make red grapes. So instead of crushing the grapes and getting the juice and then fermenting the juice separately and throwing the skins away, what you do is you basically ferment the grapes, the white grapes on their skin. And we used Viognier for ours. So it, you know, has a lot of that typical Viognier aromatics, but it doesn't necessarily have the Viognier texture because it's got more tannins and things like that you normally don't get in a white wine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Okay, there you go.
It's fun. We're still doing our traditional wines too. Yeah.
Probably easier to handle, I would think, in terms of fermentation, or is it not I don't think it's terribly delicate at that point.
No, it's not very delicate. No, and it's, you know, the more skin contact, the better, the more aromatics you get. I mean, when it was fermenting, it was just absolutely beautiful, and it was really interesting. It was my first time, you know, trying that out, so it's kind of been fun to, like, having been in the industry for so many years, and my day job, I just make Chardonnay and Pinot Noirs, so it's nice to do something a little bit wacky. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I know that you kind of like to do the horror theme, so when you come out with your orange wine, is it going to be like a Clockwork Orange?
It's interesting. Yeah, that's. I mean, we haven't actually come up with our later, the newer ones. So, like, well, I should probably explain for the other ones. The Chenin Blanc, the current releases, and we're going to do the repeats for the Chenin as well for next batch of releases. Is that right?
I think vintage.
Wow, my brain is on fire today. So the Chenin Blanc is from Jurassic Vineyard. Jurassic Park Vineyard. So obviously that's our final. So it's got the dinosaur in the front, and it's Dr. Ellie Sattler from Jurassic Park is the final girl. Our rosé of Merlot is it's a little bit darker than your traditional rosés. So it's Emma Stone's character Wichita from Zombieland. Our red blend, which Keith, I think you've also tried, because I think you even came along to that launch party, if I'm not mistaken.
We were there. Yeah.
Yeah, and that is the red blend is a Syrah Grenache, and it's the opposite of our previous year's Grenache Syrah. We just sort of flipped the proportions of the grape varietals, and it's also an unfined, unfiltered wine. And that one is called Adelaide or Red from the movie Us. A movie that came out in 2018. Yeah. So did that wine that was.
It's essentially like the bizarro version, or like the
dark evil opposite.
Yeah, the evil twin version of our previous.
Yeah. Of our previous blend. And then we have the Petit Verdot, which is Barbara from Night of the Living Dead, because it's sort of unassuming and in the background, typical of the Bordeaux blender that it often is as a Petit Verdot. But it's 100% Petit Verdot, and it stands on its own as a really great red, like big red wine, sort of in the same sort of style, but so in the same kind of categorization as, say, something like a Cab Franc or Cab Sav,
right.
Like something that would go well with, like, you know, your smoked barbecue stuff or pig and all that.
We literally this past weekend had ribeye with your Petit Verdot.
Well, Petit Verdot has got such depth and such character. It's just phenomenal.
And these two do it right, let me tell you. It's just a delicious wine.
I'm looking forward to trying that. I know you guys know who the Stoltman Winery
is. Yes. I
belong to their club, and I've gotten to know the family pretty well.
Yeah.
They make, I just drank the other night, a Para Maria, which is 80% Syrah and 20% Petit Verdot.
Yep.
And I swear to you that Petit Verdot, the body and the character that brings to the show, so to speak, it's just such a beautiful wine.
Well, that's actually probably why, Anna can correct me on this, but that's why they typically blend it, is to add the structure and
Typically in Bordeaux, it adds just the color is always so vibrant. Syrah doesn't need it in this area, but Bordeaux, it can, doesn't get that bricky color as much. The acidity is just absolutely beautiful and really can bring a blend together.
Mm-hmm.
And then, it usually has really good tannin structure and very unique aromatics. They tend to have characteristics of violets, as well as those more delicate red fruits. So they can be really beautiful. And so it's a great blender for that reason. And that's also one of the reasons that we make it our third wheel is getting a little wild over here.
I thought that was Peter.
Yeah.
He's just ramping up because he knows that he's destined for, what's going to happen. You have all these grandiose plans, going to take over the world. The fact is, he's going to get into wine.
I think probably if he's smart, he'd get into wine because there's, there's less chance of getting frustrated by by the politics of things.
Amen to that. Amen to that. Yeah.
Or he's going to develop the first nanobot wine, is what I'm
saying. Oh, that basically as soon as he does, LA will be the first to be all over it,
Keith, I'm going to have to pull your union card if you keep on talking about nanobot wines.
we look into it, and Keith's got $20,000 worth of shares in nanotechnology or something.
Exactly. That's why he keeps praying. He's planting little seeds all over the place.
Little nano seeds. Little nano seeds everywhere.
Little nano seeds.
Well, so
this is fun.
Yeah, it's great. And so what, any other new kind of varietals you guys playing with right now, or any?
Yeah, well, let's see. This harvest, we've stuck with our traditional, the Petit Verdot is something we're always going to do. It's sort of our, you know, signature wine. Chenin, we've done the last 2 years in a row, so that's very normal.
Now he's done it.
Yeah, all bets are off. And then we've also, so the orange wine, Viognier, that's a new one for us, as we just mentioned. Our rosé, so we always like to have a rosé, but we kind of like to play around with the different variety of rosé. So we had a Pinot Noir rosé, then a rosé of Merlot, which was a Saunier versus a direct press, which was a Pinot Noir. And now we've done a Syrah to be kind of, you know, more traditional French Provençal style.
Very nice.
Variety. And then the last one, which is kind of a weird one, again, you know, getting into that whole natural wine world. This year we're making a Piquette. So it's actually turned out quite surprisingly nice.
Say that one again. What is it?
It's a Piquette. So it's not a
Piquette. Yeah.
It's not a great variety, but it's a style of wine, and it's
a style of making, right?
Traditional, like a French farmhouse wine instead of like a farmhouse beer. Traditionally, they would take the skins, leftover skins from winemaking, from, you know, after you press the grapes, and they would give those to the farm workers, and they were permitted to use that to basically, you add water back and then let that soak for a few days. And then that will actually extract more of the sugars and more of the acid. Then you press it a second time and then it ferments on its own. And so you end up with this lower alcohol wine product, I guess. I don't know technically what it is. It's interesting. So ours is made from the Syrah skins. So it has, and it actually ended up sitting on there for about 5 days, so it's very dark. And then we pressed it, we pressed it on top of our friend's, because you need more skins in the press for the press to work better. So we pressed it on top of some Gamay skins that had really bright acid, and so it's actually really pretty. And the plan is to, we've saved some juice from harvest, and we're planning to add the juice back and then bottle that as sort of like a sparkling wine. So it'll be like slightly fizzy, not very fizzy. Yeah.
Kind of an affordable alternative to a sparkling.
Fun. That sounds really fun.
So it should be really interesting. Yeah. Fingers crossed the sparkling process works.
Yeah.
It's really pretty as it is on its own, but I think it'll be more fun with some bubbles.
Because we don't have a sparkling in our repertoire.
Yeah, and it'll be like a very nice chillable red. So you just throw it in your fridge for like your summer barbecues or, you know, springtime.
That's going to be fun. Hangout. I can't wait for that. I want to get some of that.
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier to hide nanobots in sparkling wine, I think.
Oh, yeah, because they fit right inside the bubbles. And so people just ingest them and they don't even know what's happening.
And then it'll be pretty good for a back-to-back for next year for the Dodgers back-to-back wins.
There you go. They're not going to win this time, I promise you.
Uh-oh, you're talking to, what are you, you're a Pirate guy,
baseball. Right? Well, I'm a Pittsburgh Pirates guy. I'm smarter than that. I understand they're not going to be in the World Series, but the Dodgers are a great team. No question about it. I can't take it if they're back in the playoffs. I'm really going to have a tough time.
That's fair enough. You just want someone else to have a go, right?
I'm a fair guy.
Yeah. Well, if the team ever deserved a World Series win, it's the Dodgers after the last 7 years.
Oh, there's no question. Yeah. And I'm okay with it because the Pittsburgh Steelers are 8-0 in football. So I'm thinking.
Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah. Pittsburgh, what about the Penguins? How are the Penguins going?
They did badly this year. They weren't as good this year. So I'm not as happy with them.
You know why? Because Batman. Sorry.
That was really bad.
It was really stupid. Like, wah.
It's funny how you it's funny how the podcast that you know the podcast is concerning some things with you know Mark and with Keith, but you've become irrelevant today.
It's my weird non sequitur thing. Is you're like, what? Keith, are you trying hard? Are you that moronic? No, I'm just
let
moronic.
Me just talk to the nice people about their wine and the horror, and you go do your thing.
All right. No one cares about the penguins. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about pandemics as well. Don't forget that. That's that fun.
There you go. We did. We talked about that. Yeah.
We did.
Having a look at that something today. Funnily enough, just on the risk side of things, just some things that were happening in the world, including the pandemic, and I was perusing through some stuff, some old work, where I would as part of like when you're doing a risk workshop. You might establish the context of the world that you live in. So right. For an organization, you'd be looking at, you know, your other businesses or organizations you work with, the local city or state that you're operating in, and the national level, and then globally what's going on in the world in the next sort of 10 years. And I was looking at all the World Economic Forum global risks. They do a report each year, and all the ones from 2013 and 14 are all starting to come home to roost. All the stuff about pandemics, although they were warning also about the antibacterial ones that are sort of set to happen pretty soon too. They're expected to go through this process multiple times a decade. And then, you know, some other stuff about the balkanization of the internet and division, but everyone was always talking about was someone in other countries. They never were really thinking of it would manifest itself in the West, but here we are. So happy day.
Right.
And here we are.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you guys have, you're small business owners, and so let's get your opinion. You've kind of opened that can up, Pete. Are you optimistic? Do you think there's a future here?
That's all.
With our small business or just.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, both.
Yeah. And it's a good point because so many businesses are struggling during this whole thing. I mean, I'm sure you're feeling it as well. Everybody's, you know, it's a big shit sandwich. We all have to bite it. I mean, it's horrifying.
I mean, we released our first ones in September of last year.
Yeah.
And, you know, right into the Halloween season. So that was great. So we did fairly well, but we were starting to establish ourselves. And we were really starting to get some traction and did some in-home events early March. And then, a lot of people wanted to do more events. Those were really successful for us. And then all of a sudden everything shut down.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've had to be a little
adaptive.
Yeah. And like offering a lot more specials and trying to get.
Well, actually also changing the way that we do it as well. So doing the virtual events. Trying to promote things differently as well, like a much greater focus online and being thoughtful about how we approach it. You know, that's for half our business life, we've been operating under a pandemic.
Yeah.
So like that's just kind of weird with lockdowns and things like that. But the experience that I remember talking to who was did risk and other things in Christchurch City Council, my equivalent, we were just swapping ideas around. It was a little bit of a powwow session. This was a few years after the earthquake that happened in Christchurch, and he sort of said,
"Oh wow,
yeah." So like, and at the time that I was talking to him, there were a few places where buildings were pulled down. It looked a little bit like certain streets in Christchurch still looked like a bit of a war zone because the buildings were destroyed and things. And he said that what happened out of this experience was that a lot of people were like, some people really just weren't able to handle it. For obvious reasons. I mean, I didn't like the earthquake experiences that I had too. And they often left. And the ones that did stay really were very entrepreneurial in spirit. And so you started to see these alternative craft stores and coffee shops are made out of like shipping containers. And there was an entire sort of section of Christchurch, which was all just shipping containers full of the old businesses that had their buildings destroyed. And that became part of the culture. And so I think the lesson there is, and it can't apply to everyone, but there is that whole idea of that you have to try to be adaptive. And I noticed that like even Vino and Amici's, they have been pretty adaptive as well on how they do it. And also us, I think they're selling coffees now and also hand sanitizers and various other bits and pieces, which is really cool. But, the thing is that the old good spirit only takes you so far. You really do need assistance. And I think there is a the government either provides assistance to small businesses or this recession pandemic thing becomes what, you know, to small business, what housing was in 2008. And you really don't want to. We've seen now the consequences of what happens if you don't help families in the middle class. and you see right. millions upon millions of Americans suffer and lose their jobs and lose their homes and then consequently their communities. Now, if you do that to small business, the small businesses won't die out. They'll just be gobbled up by hedge funds and all the rest of it. And then you'll just see a whole lot of an even greater anger and division in society. And then this will seem like nothing compared to what can happen if the small businesses go down too.
Well, I would say, though, you know, just, I mean, I don't know the statistics, the numbers on it, though, but a lot of restaurants and where, you know, we weren't having our wines carried in a lot of restaurants because we hadn't gotten to that point yet. But a lot of other small wineries and, like, again, we don't take ourselves that seriously with our horror thing. So we're kind of trying to reach different audiences, but a lot of smaller boutique wineries are having serious issues because, you know, their main business is selling their wines to restaurants and those restaurants have been shut down and, you know, a lot of them aren't ever going to open again. So it's pretty devastating for the wine industry and also for the restaurant industry, which are pretty closely connected.
So it's like, I don't have the exact number, but think about all the small businesses that are out there, the millions of small businesses. They're the backbone of employment in America and the backbone of communities. You know, if you shut down a whole bunch of small businesses, whole entire towns get shut down. And then what happens? You know, like you really have a massive impact on society. So, yeah, you know, like the homes in 2008, small businesses are that in 2020. And that's my biggest concern and risk. And I would say if there are stimulus was passed earlier this year, which was, I think, a really good thing, probably saved a lot. But if we don't actually maintain that and come up with an appropriate plan to just help them survive, then we'll have some serious consequences. And yes, garden beds need to start to be made. And
I'm in hopes that it goes better than that. I really am. I want to be optimistic. I'm cautious, but I'm just in hopes.
It's always better to be optimistic with a plan than it is to just to be optimistic, you know?
Amen.
Our home base is a small town of Los Alamos, and we have quite a few restaurants here. Mm-hmm. And those restaurants, in particular Bell's restaurant, I mean, a lot of them have been really innovative in their methods for, you know, like getting
food out there.
Allowing people to order food and things like that. And I mean, they've been doing well. I'm sure it's exhausting and not nearly as profitable as they would have hoped, but they seem to be surviving. And the small communities, because I mean, in a small community, like, we need those restaurants. We want those restaurants to continue. So a lot of people were doing takeout. So that gives me hope that, you know, a lot of small communities are able to kind of rally around each other.
The domino effect can happen. Like, so, you know, small businesses go under because these smaller businesses that they work with go under. So there's that domino effect, but it works the other way. So if we help each other out, that also, you know, you prop that small business up, it helps you out too. You know, this, anyway, it's all about attitude, really.
And I agree with that. A lot of this is trying to be as positive as possible. We know that, you know, we're talking about just one segment, the restaurant business, but there's tons of other businesses who are, in the industrial supply businesses right now, their industrial supply is almost a standstill because so many people aren't working, therefore nothing's happening. And so, you know, this is resonating through tons of industries. And that's one of the things that scare me. Is just, gee whiz, how do we climb out of this? How do we climb out of it?
Yeah.
Well, we will climb out of it. It's just a matter of, it's just a matter of who climbs out of it and how, I guess. So, it's a great opportunity to buy stocks at the moment too, to certain companies. So
theoretically, but the market's not really going down. So.
Yeah, no, the companies that are benefiting out of this. There's a transfer of wealth going on, so. See how that
works. That's true too. Well,
heavily invested in nanobot technology, so I'm
so you will be rich soon.
Yeah.
And on that note,
so real quick, so we can anybody who's listening and interested in Final Girl Wines, I believe you have a great website, right? Finalgirlwines.com or
.com. Yeah, that's correct. Finalgirlwines.com.
Great website, and I'm excited. Final Girl Wines, you can still taste up in California. You can taste up in Solvang and up in Santa Maria at Vino et Amici's and at The Good Life.
The Good Life, both available there for purchase.
Right on.
Guys, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Peter and Anna. Thank you. We could talk hours and hours about horror, so and your wonderful wine.
Definitely.
Well, I want to say one thing. If people are in the local area and want to have us, you know, have this podcast replicated in a live show and they want to taste our wines in one of those locations, just go to the website and contact us either by phone or email. And we can organise a time if people are travelling up there for a bit of a break, or if they're locals in the area, we're happy to talk through the wines as well.
Yeah, happy to meet you at those locations. Lovely. Yeah.
We,
I might take you up on that myself.
Yeah, I love it when you guys come out to Vino and, you know, pitch your wines. It's so much fun having you guys there. And
yeah, Dawn and Kurt are great fun. Yeah,
and it's so great. I mean, like, I appreciate it and love it because it's so nice to see people enjoying our product and actually.
Because it's wonderful. Yeah, you truly make some great wines. So you're doing good. Last question. Favorite zombie movie? Peter?
Peter, go.
Favorite zombie movie?
I'd have to probably go Shaun of the Dead because I just think it's great.
That's a great movie. I'm going to say Zombieland because it has one of my all-time favorite cameos.
Yeah, that's...
And
Bill Murray?
Bill Murray. It's just so hilarious. I can't handle it.
All right, here's my favorite line from that whole thing. Do you have any regrets, Garfield, maybe?
Yeah, so good. It's so good.
All right. Well, hey, thank you both very much for coming on our show. Y'all have been listening to Considering Some Things. I'm Keith
Which
Talk.
Can be heard. I'm Mark Storer. Can be heard everywhere. Spotify, iTunes, TuneIn.
Stitcher, Intune.
TuneIn. Amazon. And come Amazon. On in and join us.
Amazon.
Amming, amazing, the company that's taking over the world right now.
Yeah, well, due to nanobot technology.
Have a good night, everybody.
Take care, everybody. Thank you.